Look, if you're hoping for a quiet Monday, the news cycle didn't get the memo. We're tracking a potential geopolitical pivot between the U.S. and Iran, a security breach at the White House, and Donald Trump's latest financial maneuvers. Plus, we're following up on the ongoing AI shift we've been tracking, specifically how the agentic web is about to change how you use the internet. Here's what's actually happening. The United States and Iran are reportedly moving toward a 60-day memorandum of understanding. Under the terms of the potential deal, the U.S. would ease certain sanctions and maritime restrictions in exchange for Iran cooling its uranium enrichment and ensuring safe passage for commercial tankers in the region. The goal here is pretty straightforward on paper: de-escalate a situation that has been redlining for months. The stakes for this are massive, because the region is essentially the world's jugular for oil. If the friction eases, we're looking at a boost in global fuel supply that could actually start dragging down the price of things like fertilizer and groceries. It's not just about the pump, it's about the entire global supply chain. But don't get too comfortable. Iranian state media is already sounding incredibly skeptical, and while the deal aims to pause the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, that's a heavy lift given that previous ceasefires haven't exactly held. If this feels like a sudden pivot, that's because it is. Analysts are already framing this as a strategic shift. After a massive military campaign and shifting goals, ranging from regime change to nuclear prevention, Iran is essentially entering these talks from a position of significant regional influence. That's a huge win for Tehran. It signals to every other player in the Middle East that the U.S. can't necessarily dictate terms anymore. If you're a Gulf state looking for security guarantees, you're probably looking at this and wondering if the American umbrella has some pretty significant holes in it. Closer to home, we had another security breach at the White House. A 21-year-old man was shot and killed by security forces near the grounds. This wasn't a random occurrence. The suspect apparently had a history of warnings to stay away from the area. This is yet another high-profile security failure near the president in a very short window. It's a shitty situation that's becoming a recurring theme, and it's a miracle more people haven't been caught in the crossfire. While we're on the subject of the White House, the way the administration is handling money and the law is getting, well, brazen is one word for it. Donald Trump has reportedly engaged in a massive amount of personal stock trading. The timing is what smells off. We're talking about buying Nvidia stock right before approving chip sales to China, or investing in Oracle just before the TikTok deal. Then there's the IRS situation. Trump settled a massive long-standing tax dispute with the IRS for a fraction of the original claimed amount. That money is being funneled into what's being called an anti-weaponization fund to compensate victims of lawfare. Critics are calling it a slush fund for political allies, and the guy overseeing it at the DOJ is Todd Blanche, Trump's personal attorney. But the real kicker is the self-granted tax exemption. Trump signed an agreement that basically bars the government from prosecuting any tax claims against him, his family, or his businesses for past returns. This isn't a pardon for a specific crime, it's a proactive shield. He's essentially created a private legal tier where the rules for every other taxpayer in America just don't apply to him. It's a hell of a thing to watch in real time. On the national security front, the administration just dropped its new counterterrorism strategy, and the omissions are louder than the inclusions. The strategy, influenced by Sebastian Gorka, completely leaves out any mention of far-right extremism. That's a choice, especially since reporting from the ground has linked recent domestic attacks to global far-right accelerationist movements. Instead, the document pivots to left-wing extremists and narco-terrorists like Mexican cartels and MS-13. Now, cartels are obviously a massive criminal problem, but labeling them terrorists is a specific legal and operational shift. It moves them into a different bucket for intelligence and military resources. Experts are calling this unserious and purely political, especially since the document mentions Joe Biden by name multiple times. It feels less like a security assessment and more like a campaign press release. Moving across the pond, or down under, Australian politics is hitting a weird inflection point. former Prime Minister Tony Abbott is likely going to be appointed as the Liberal Party president. Usually this is a boring administrative role for a behind-the-scenes type, but Abbott is a heavyweight. The party is hemorrhaging support, with polls showing they could actually lose their spot as the formal opposition to Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. At the same time, the Teal Independents are looking at forming their own formal party. The whole political landscape in Australia is basically being shoved into a blender. Speaking of political upheaval, Alberta is reportedly exploring the idea of a referendum on independence. It's the classic oil-rich province versus centrist federal government drama we've seen before, but it's escalating. Proponents argue that being part of Canada is actually strangling Alberta's economic growth. It's got a very Western Australia vibe to it, that recurring itch to secede whenever the federal government starts annoying the local mining or oil barons. Finally, let's look at India, where a parody group called the Cockroach Janta Party is actually making the government nervous. This movement started after India's Chief Justice compared unemployed youth to cockroaches. The youth took the insult and ran with it, creating a massive online presence representing the frustrated and jobless. They started blocking the party's website and social media accounts. It's a classic move. When you can't fix the unemployment problem, just try to mute the people complaining about it. Organizers are convinced the government is behind the digital crackdown, which honestly usually means the parody is hitting a little too close to home. The landscape of artificial intelligence is shifting from simple chatbots to what the industry is calling agentic systems, AI that doesn't just answer questions, but actually performs tasks. This transition is forcing a fundamental rethink of how we work, how websites are built, and whether a job apocalypse is actually on the table. According to a series of reports on the future of work, we are seeing the emergence of an infinite backlog. The idea here is that as AI agents begin to commoditize routine tasks like basic coding and writing, they aren't actually reducing the total amount of work to be done. Instead, they are freeing up human capacity to tackle complex expert-level problems that were previously too time-consuming to even attempt. Basically, the more we automate the sameness of daily tasks, the higher the market value climbs for human judgment and difference. We're also seeing a shift in how these tools are deployed. The trend is moving away from individual personal AI assistants toward unit agents or super agents that serve entire teams. These agents are being integrated into new work operating systems like Codex and Claude Code, environments where humans and AI collaborate in the same workspace in real time. Look, the human sandwich model is the new standard here. Humans frame the task, the AI executes the middle, and the human judges the outcome. While this makes existing skills cheaper, in a sense, it's also creating new roles, like the forward-deployed engineer, someone whose entire job is just managing and optimizing these AI agents. The consensus in the reporting is that this is an expansion of the workforce, not a reduction. If you can ride the models, you're probably going to be fine. But there's a catch. Most people are still stuck in first gear. A report on AI utilization found a massive productivity gap. While 92% of organizations say they are using AI, only 7% feel they're getting any real benefit out of it. The problem is that most users are treating ChatGPT like a glorified spell checker or a basic text editor. To actually get value, the reporting suggests an amazing intern mentality. Giving the AI deep context about your specific role and challenges, then engaging in an iterative back-and-forth dialogue. If you aren't talking to it like a partner, you're essentially leaving the engine in neutral. Beyond the office, the very structure of the internet is being re-architected to accommodate these agents. At the center of this is something called WebMCP, or Machine Control Protocol. Think of it as a standardized API that allows AI models to bypass the copy-paste routine and interact directly with a website's functions. An AI agent using WebMCP could theoretically add to cart or checkout on its own, without a human clicking through a GUI. This leads to a pretty significant shift for the agentic web. We're moving toward a world where websites aren't just for people to read. They are toolkits for AI to use. Google is already signaling this shift, leaning into AI-driven search results that prioritize direct answers and agentic actions over traditional organic links. This is where things get a little bleak for the content creators. If AI can directly access and process web information to perform tasks, the traditional SEO model, where you write a tutorial to get clicks and ad revenue, starts to fall apart. There is a growing concern that if AI can synthesize everything on the web instantly, the people who actually write the tutorials, books, and documentation will be disincentivized from creating anything new. The counter-argument here is that AI-generated code still lacks quality in complex areas like CSS and accessibility, meaning we still need humans to provide the oversight. But the reality is that we are moving toward a dual-user web. If you're building a site or writing content today, you're no longer just writing for a person with a screen, you're writing instructions for an agent. It's a weird paradox. The more we automate, the more we seem to need high-level human intervention to make sure the automation doesn't produce a mountain of average. The AI apocalypse might not be a lack of jobs, but a massive increase in the complexity of the jobs we have left. Anyway, that's the state of the machine today. Use the intern, don't let it drive alone, and maybe start looking at how your own work looks through the eyes of an agent. Because that's clearly where the money is going. And speaking of where the money is going, the markets are currently having a bit of a meltdown over bond yields and the reality of debt. Here's the business breakdown. Bond yields are spiking, and the market is finally panicking about inflation and geopolitical instability. This shift is forcing a total repricing of risk. According to the Prof. G-Pod, investors are moving capital out of equities and into safer, higher-yield investments, which is making borrowing more expensive for everyone from homeowners to major corporations. The math here is getting ugly. U.S. debt servicing costs are projected to hit $1 trillion by 2026. There's something called Ferguson's Law, which suggests that when a country's debt interest exceeds its defense budget, it's a signal of a great power in decline. We're staring right at that line. This isn't just a macro headache. It's a direct threat to private credit and AI companies that have been fueling their growth with debt. The pod described the potential fallout for these leveraged firms as a shavings of shit on a shit salad scenario, where rising costs meet slowing revenue. Look, we've spent years pretending capital is free. Now that the bill is coming due, investors still seem weirdly optimistic, or maybe they're just too politically invested to admit the Fed might have missed the mark. Either way, the floor is getting a lot thinner. Speaking of optimistic valuations, SpaceX is reportedly eyeing an IPO with a $2 trillion price tag. While Starlink is a legitimate, profitable business, the Prof. G-Pod notes that the total valuation is being propped up by the company's AI division. In the pod's view, that division is currently just a massive money furnace, and they even went as far as to draw comparisons to the WeWork hype cycle. The reality is that SpaceX's revenue growth is actually pretty modest compared to big tech standards. Its valuation is significantly higher than companies like Nvidia, which are actually growing faster and making more money. It feels like a compelling narrative for retail investors is being used to paper over the fact that the financial fundamentals just don't add up to $2 trillion yet. It's a hell of a story, but at some point, the spreadsheets have to matter. In the media world, James Murdoch has acquired the Vox Media Podcast Network, along with New York Magazine. According to the Prof. G-Pod, New York Magazine is essentially a trophy asset, something you buy for the ego and the cultural clout rather than the margins. The real business play here is the podcast network. Podcasting is currently the fastest-growing advertising channel outside of Google and Meta. Murdoch's strategy seems to be a classic roll-up. Aggregate enough podcast assets to mitigate the risk of losing a single star host and create a scale that advertisers can't ignore. Digital media has been a graveyard for years, but Murdoch is betting that the scalability of audio is the one corner of the industry that can actually deliver a return. Honestly, it's a smart move to pivot away from the wreckage of traditional digital publishing and into something people actually pay attention to for more than 8 seconds. It's easy to get buried in the data and the macro doom, right? If you're feeling the pressure, there's some new thinking on how to actually manage the mental load of all this. Executive coach Joe Hudson is pushing a strategy for high achievers that swaps traditional self-improvement for what he calls radical self-understanding. Hudson's core argument is that the standard self-help narrative, the idea that you are fundamentally broken and need fixing, is actually the primary driver of most personal struggles. He contends that repressed emotions create internal constriction, which neurologically blocks your ability to make clear decisions. It's a bit of a middle finger to the entire hustle harder industry, suggesting that your productivity problems are actually just unprocessed feelings from childhood. To fix this, Hudson proposes a golden algorithm where you intentionally invite in the exact emotion you're trying to avoid. The goal isn't to wallow, but to use curiosity to dissipate the power that avoided emotion has over your behavior. He notes that high achievers often rely on dirty fuel, identities built on past successes that eventually lead to burnout when industries like tech inevitably shift. By identifying with your essential self rather than a job title, you supposedly become more adaptable to things like AI disruption. It sounds a little California retreat, but if it stops the doom scrolling and the burnout, maybe there's something to it. On the tactical side of focus, a separate strategy for extreme results is gaining traction, centered on the idea that distraction is the literal antithesis of execution. The framework requires a process of permanent rejection, severing ties with time-consuming jobs or habits, rather than just avoiding them temporarily. It's based on the principle that pursuing several good ideas leads to incremental gains, while committing to a few great ones yields disproportionate outcomes. You consolidate what's left into focused time blocks to maximize impact. This mirrors a modernized Stoic framework currently being used in coaching, which layers awareness and a peaceful base before setting any goals. The process uses the concept of processe, continuous observation of your thoughts, to distinguish between what you can actually control and what you can't. They call this prepaying the worst case, where you mentally rehearse failure to take the sting out of it before you even start. It's essentially pessimism as a productivity tool, which honestly feels a lot more honest than a vision board. Of course, if you want to talk about prepaying the worst case, just look at the Prem. Tottenham fans have had a hell of a weekend. Tottenham Hotspur barely stayed in the Premier League on the final day of the season. They secured a 1-0 victory over Everton to guarantee their safety, a result that effectively sent West Ham down to the Championship, despite West Ham winning their own final match. It was that close. The season for Spurs was defined by a massive gap between the club's goals and what actually happened on the pitch. It started with a coaching appointment that fundamentally clashed with the players they had on the roster, which ended up killing any offensive creativity. Instead of a cohesive system, the team leaned on individual play, which didn't just hurt the scoreboard, it reportedly wrecked the players' confidence. Look, you can't just plug a random philosophy into a squad that isn't built for it and expect magic. It's like trying to run high-end software on a flip phone. Eventually, the whole thing just freezes up. A new coach eventually came in and showed some potential, but the underlying issue remained. The current squad isn't built for a modern tactical approach. The lack of an attacking repertoire and a failure to adapt throughout the year turned the season into a psychological grind. Now, the club is facing a total identity crisis. They're looking at a massive rebuilding project where they have to align their scouting and recruitment with whatever coaching philosophy they actually want to commit to. Here's the thing. Staying up is great for the balance sheet, but the way they did it was incredibly messy. The reporting suggests there is a deep climate of doubt about whether this club can actually compete at the top level anymore. If they don't fix the recruitment and find a strategic alignment between the front office and the dugout, they're just going to stagnate. Honestly, watching a club of this size white-knuckle their way to the final day just to avoid the drop is a shitty situation for the fans. They've reached an inflection point where they either commit to a real philosophy or they keep drifting into irrelevance. It's not just about the 3 points anymore. It's about figuring out what the hell they're even trying to be. Before we get out of here, a few random threads to pull on while you're drinking your coffee. First, let's talk about the British pub. It's not just a place to get hammered. it's basically the last functional piece of social infrastructure they have left. These spots act as neutral ground where people actually talk to neighbors they don't even like, which is a hell of a lot more than you can say for your local Starbucks. To survive the current economy, they're pivoting to high-end food and tighter operations. But the soul of the thing, that beautiful, chaotic community energy, is still the whole point. Over in the snack world, Justin Gold of Justin's Nut Butter didn't just get lucky with a blender. He spent years obsessing over food chemistry, doing things like grinding freeze-dried strawberries into dust to fix texture issues that would have broken a lesser man. It's a reminder that behind every overnight success, there's a lot of hard work that isn't always obvious. Success in the grocery aisle is usually someone who spent way too much time thinking about the molecular density of a peanut. If you're feeling shitty about not owning a home yet, here's some actual data to make you feel better. In most high-cost cities, renting is actually the smarter financial move right now. When you factor in property taxes, the endless black hole of maintenance, and the opportunity cost of tying up your cash, owning a place can cost double what you pay in rent. Equity is great, sure, but so is not being house poor because your water heater exploded. Finally, a bit of linguistics. The word Snickelfritz, which you've probably heard used for a rowdy kid, has a pretty literal German origin. It basically translates to little boy's wiener. It eventually drifted into a term for a mischievous scamp, which is a hell of a semantic journey for a word to take. Just something to keep in mind next time you use it as a cute nickname at a family reunion. That's the board for Monday. Go easy on the Snickelfritzes today.